time now for hour number two of this weekend's big two-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Michael Harrison here with you in the anchor chair, and the host of the program is Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. Carol is going to kick this hour off now in conversation with Kathy Reichs. She's a forensic anthropologist and the inspiration for the hit Fox TV series Bones. She's also a New York Times bestselling author, and she's going to talk to Carol about her latest mystery, Bones of the Lost, published by Scribner.
Before we talk about your latest mystery adventure, Bones of the Lost, how old were you when you realized you had an interest in science? And for those who don't know, what does a forensic scientist do?
Well, I think from very young, I wanted to be a scientist, and I had some vague idea of wearing a white lab coat and peering through a microscope. And as it turned out, that's actually what I spend quite a bit of my time doing. What is a forensic scientist? That's broad. That could be, it's a scientist with specific training relative to questions of law, questions that will end up in court. Their expertise could be chemistry or ballistics or microbiology. I'm a forensic anthropologist, so my specific skills involve the human skeleton. And I work with medical examiners, coroners, sometimes prosecutors, defense attorneys, the military, to look at what we can get out of bones. And it's in bodies that are compromised, that are burned or mutilated or decomposed or mummified or dismembered. For some reason, you can't do a regular autopsy. So I usually address two questions. One would be identity. Who is it? And the second would be cause of death. What happened to this person that they've ended up in the coroner's office?
Now, let's talk about your latest thriller, Bones of the Lost. It is just amazing. It starts with a timely topic, considering that recently in the news we had a huge sweep and arrest of people across the country who were alleged to be involved in the human trafficking of young girls. And Tempe Brennan is brought into the case of a young girl found dead along the side of a desolate road. And the question is, was she an illegal immigrant, a hit-and-run victim, or a victim of human trafficking? And I was horrified to learn from your book, Kathy, that other than drugs and guns, humans are the most smuggled commodity on Earth. Any comments?
Well, if you think of it, it's horrifying. It is horrifying. These young girls are lured from Asia, from Eastern Europe, from a number of places, by promises of jobs as nannies or domestics or whatever. And then when they get here, maybe without a passport, probably not speaking the language, no money, they're trapped. And if you think about it, if you smuggle arms or you smuggle drugs, you can sell them once. Whereas with a human being, you can make money again and again and again and again through that woman by forcing that individual to participate in the sex trade. So, yeah, it's a big problem.
Now, in addition to the young girl's mysterious death, Tempe's asked at the same time to examine a bundle of ancient Peruvian dog mummies smuggled in a case of pottery and confiscated by the U.S. Customs. And then, as if she didn't have enough piled on her plate, she's asked to go to Afghanistan to exhume the bodies of two locals that were supposed to, or it said, were killed by a U.S. lieutenant who's under investigation for their murder. Now, despite the fact that your main character is smart and very strong, didn't you feel some sympathy with all those cases vying for her attention at once? My goodness.
Yes, and I know that feeling. You know, I consult. I don't work full-time at the lab, and weeks can go by and nothing, and then all of a sudden four cases will come in at the same time. So I feel total sympathy for her.
Now, the intriguing question that your book asks, among others, is there some connection between the trafficking of the antiquities, such as the dog mummies, the poor unidentified dead girl, and the trafficking of human beings, and the suspense in your novel just bills and bills. So people are going to have to read the book to find out what the connection is, because it is fascinating. Now, when it comes to the mysteries you write, you say not every book is based on a specific case, but they're related to something you've done. And so you were invited on this USO tour with five other best-selling writers. You went to Afghanistan. And Bones of the Lost really draws on that experience. So what did you learn from visiting our military personnel serving there, and what surprised you the most about your visit?
I went with four other authors. We went to thank the troops for their service. We went to Kyrgyzstan and Afghanistan. I was struck by the fact that we went there to thank them, and they spent their whole time thanking us. And yet they are living there under very difficult conditions and dangerous conditions. The first night we were there at Bagram Air Force Base, we took incoming mortar or rockets. And they're under that kind of threat, that kind of tension all the time. So I wanted to bring some of that out in the story.
And you certainly did. Now, I wanted to mention, of course, the ever so popular TV show Bones, based on your mystery thriller. And again, you have so much on your plate because you're the producer, and it certainly must keep you busy. And do you really read every script, and why is that important?
I do read every script because my role as a producer is to keep the science honest. So I give feedback on that, on the terminology and the techniques that are being used, because we won't use anything that doesn't really exist. I don't have to do nearly as much now as I did 9 seasons ago, because they really get it. The writers are so sophisticated. They're almost like graduate students in forensic anthropology. And also Emily and David, I mean, they really know the terminology and can whip off all these long terms.
And what wonderful actors they are. Now, what do you think the impact has had of seeing so many forensic novels and TV shows that the reading and viewing public has been exposed to? Is it a good thing? Does it have a downside?
I think it's a good thing. I think one of the reasons I wrote my very first book and used Temperance Brennan as the main character is it's gotten kids excited about science, and particularly young girls excited about science. So I think that's fantastic. When I see who comes to my readings and signings, and there's so many young girls and they're so excited about it, that I think that's a really good sign. The downside is that, you know, the myth of television is that every single crime gets solved, and that's not really true.
In an hour, right?
In an hour, yeah. Now, one of the things we don't do things like, you know, get your DNA results in 10 minutes like they do on some shows. But every case doesn't get solved. I have a little warehouse, and in there are boxes, and in them are skeletons that maybe haven't been ID'd, or they've been ID'd, but maybe no perpetrator has been arrested or tried. So that's one of the myths, the idea that science can solve every single question. That's an unfortunate myth.
Now, what's your secret for being able to juggle all the areas in your professional life as a forensic anthropologist, one of only 82 forensic anthropologists that have been certified by the American Board of Forensic Anthropology? I was really impressed about that. And then, of course, you're the writer of the adult thriller series starring Tempe Brenny. And then you have your new youth author spinoff series called Virals, about Tempe's teenage grandniece and her crime-solving friends. So how do you manage?
Yeah, you got to be organized and disciplined. Anytime I'm not traveling or on tour, I tour a lot. And anytime I'm not at the lab, that's a writing day. I stay home and I write. And I stay at it. I don't allow myself writer's block. I produce something. Now, the next day I may delete a lot of it. But if you fall into that, oh, it's not a good day kind of mindset, it's not going to be productive in the long run. So anytime I'm free, I write.
That's Kathy Rikes in conversation with Carol Marx. And the book that she's written is called Bones of the Lost, published by Scribner. If you want more information, visit the website, KathyRikes.com. And Kathy spelled with a K, and Rikes is spelled R-E-I-C-H-S.com. So it's KathyRikes.com. Coming up next, Carol Marx talks to Douglas E. Richard, the former director of biotechnology licensing for Bristol-Myers Squibb and vice president at Signal Pharmaceuticals, a company focused on cures for central nervous system and inflammatory disorders. And he's written a book called The Cure, and that's coming up next When A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy and you feel fine. But that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Doesn't always cause symptoms, but it can be prevented. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, Michael Harrison here in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of the program, Carol Marks, in conversation, as promised, with Douglas E. Richards. He was the former director of biotechnology licensing for Bristol-Myers Squibb and vice president at Signal Pharmaceuticals, a company focused on cures for central nervous system and inflammatory disorders. He's going to talk to Carol about his new book titled The Cure, published by Forge Books.
For those listeners who might not know, what's the difference between being psychotic and being a psychopath or a sociopath, which is another name for the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty confusing, even to clinicians. Basically, so the difference between psychopath and sociopath, and a lot of people don't even make a difference, but the real experts do. They psychopaths are kind of born, not made. A sociopath can develop these tendencies because of their environment, you know, where they grew up. Maybe they grew up in the mob or, you know, in a terrorist cell, whatever. And so, you know, they become kind of ruthless and get these sociopathic tendencies. A psychopath is kind of a bad seed. You know, it's more genetic and biological, and this is just how they are. And, you know, their mother could be Mother Teresa and their father Gandhi, and they would still be how they are. Now, the difference between a psychopath and a psychotic, it's unfortunate because both are called psycho. That's the abbreviation. But a psychotic is more, you know, they suffer from different, you know, hallucinations, schizophrenia. You know, they don't know right from wrong. They have little voices in their head telling them to do stuff. A psychopath is chillingly sane. A psychopath knows right from wrong. He just doesn't care.
And that's what's so, so disturbing. And, you know, I understood, you know, after reading your book that, because it made sense, that 20-30% of our male and U.S. prison population is composed of psychopaths who've done many repetitive crimes and much violence. But, you know, what really got me was the fact that, oh, boy, it's hard to believe, but I guess it's all true, that so many psychopaths have successfully integrated themselves into a variety of occupations, including the military, the legal profession, corporations, and I guess we can't be surprised, politics.
That's funny, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, it turns
out... It's not funny, but it's true, yeah.
It turns out that 1% of the population is psychopathic or can be classified. So what is a psychopath? I mean, people think of Hannibal Lecter when they think of a psychopath, and that's really, really rare. I mean, even though there's a lot of them in prison, you know, the ones that are, you know, like you say, white collar psychopaths are you know, they destroy lives as well. So what characterizes a psychopath? I mean, first off, they don't have any conscience. They're ruthless. They experience emotions very shallowly, if at all. They can be super charming. They make brilliant con artists and liars. If they're caught in a lie, they don't embarrass. They have no shame, and that's what's so funny about, you know, politicians. You know, imagine somebody who's a brilliant liar who has no shame and never gets embarrassed. You know, hard to imagine them being successful in politics. But anyway,
are you kidding?
You know, they don't have any empathy.
Right.
So this is kind of what characterizes them. And even people who study them for a living can be fooled by them because they're so charming.
Now, you said that one of the reasons that you wanted to write the book about this group of people who are the most accomplished liars in the world is that there are a lot of new findings on the nature of psychopaths. And one of the things that you had to be surprised about was the new MRI findings about the brain. So what are they discovering?
I mean, they're discovering that there are differences in the brain physiology between psychopaths and non-psychopaths. So that's actually what started me thinking about writing this novel. I mean, so it's a novel like Michael Crichton might have written. It has, you know, science elements, but it's also a thriller in the present day. It has science and science fictional elements and twists and turns and all the other good stuff that, you know, that people like in a thriller. But I like to base it on a kind of a kernel of science and accurate science. So I was reading that scientists were discovering differences in the brains of psychopaths and non-psychopaths, and I thought, well, this is really, really interesting, and it brings up a lot of potential ethical issues. So I called a guy who's doing the research, a guy named Mike Koenigs at the University of Wisconsin Medical School, and he was one of the guys who goes into prisons, and he conducts brain scans on psychopathic murderers and rapists. So, I mean, that caught my attention. So I had a 90-minute conversation with him, and it was one of the most fascinating conversations I had ever had. So I said, well, okay, you go into the prison, and they put a trailer, you know, like an 18-wheeler with an MRI machine inside the prison yard. And I said, so the guard brings you a prisoner. And what, does he have a Hannibal Lecter mask? Oh, no. You know, they're completely unrestrained. No handcuffs, no nothing. And I thought, are you kidding? This is a psychopathic murderer, and they just bring him to you? Yeah. So, okay, when you go into the back of the trailer and do the MRI scan, how many guards go in there with you? None. You're alone? You're alone in a tiny room with a psychopathic murderer who isn't restrained in any way. I mean, I was just fascinated by this, and I couldn't believe the courage of this guy, and I knew that that had to make it into the book. But, I mean, it turns out, and what he said was, yeah, they're super dangerous, but they know how to play the system. And so if they did anything to me, they would be they'd get much worse treatment in prison, put in solitary confinement. So, I mean, they're really good at pretending to be born-again Christians, you know, anything they have to do to get treated better in prison. So, so far, he hasn't run into any trouble, but I was fascinating. And
well,
I
they're like chameleons, I guess. You know, amazing that they can change to whatever conditions there are. Now, as you said earlier, you know, most experts have been fooled at one time or another by psychopaths that they've been working with or talking to. And it seems, you know, really exciting to me that in your novel, your main character, Aaron, was working on a device that could alert people that they were in 50 feet of a psychopath, as well as she was collaborating with another colleague on a possible cure. But without giving away the twists and turns of the plot, suddenly all hell breaks loose, and poor Aaron finds herself being threatened from a variety of sources. Could it be our government, aliens, or one of her scientific collaborators? Isn't she left not knowing whom she can trust? And isn't that must be one of the worst things in the world, feeling you can't trust anybody?
Yeah, absolutely. No, yeah, so she has, you know, the main character, Erin, has a devastating encounter with a psychopath as a young woman, and so she dedicates her life to understanding these monsters. And, you know, you brought up an interesting point, you know, and this is the kind of stuff I started thinking about when I first thought about doing the novel, and that is, you know, what if you had a key ring that would glow or, you know, buzz every time you were within 50 feet of a psychopath? So what would you do with that information? Because even though, you know, between you and me, psychopathic personalities are, doing a lot of unethical stuff. And I mean, it's just their nature to kind of break the law. But if they haven't been convicted yet of any crime, what would you do with that information? I mean, would you be justified in monitoring psychopaths, known psychopaths, even before they've been convicted of anything?
What a great question. Raise, because, you know, we're living in a time where, what are we talking about now? All these privacy issues and all the cameras on the street that can take pictures of us and God knows what else. So really, your thesis is so timely. And I wanted to ask you also about a little bit about the plot, because it gives readers such a fast-paced ride. It's full of twists and turns. So how did you know what all your characters were doing? Because there are a lot of them in your book at any one time. How did you keep them straight? And did you know how your novel was going to end when you started to write it?
No, I never do.
Wow.
It's scary.
Hard.
It's really scary because, and I'm not sure you can. You know, when I first started writing, I thought, you know, all authors, you know, had this deck of cards and, you know, they figured out every single detail before they began. But it's impossible to do that because until you've actually written the scene, you don't really know what you're working with. You know, it's the way I think of it is a 5,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. And you don't even know what the finished puzzle is supposed to look like. You just have these 5,000 pieces, and you don't even know what pieces you have. And so until you start laying down a few pieces, and then you kind of see where other pieces might fit, the great news about writing a novel is that you can do it in a circle. So if you're on chapter 20 and you realize that you needed an element, you can go back to chapter 1 and plant that there. But it's scary because I typically I'll be about 60 or 70% through the novel without knowing how it's going to end.
Oh, wow. So you don't have OCD. God,
no. But I got to tell you, it's so scary because I've spent hundreds of hours working on a novel, and I refuse to finish it until it passes my test of, you know, I want it to be gripping and make people think about stuff, you know, so I like to put a lot of ethics and philosophy and information in there so that, you know, not only is it entertaining, but after they finish the book, it gets them to think about stuff.
Douglas E. Richards, in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled The Cure, and it's published by Forge Books. Coming up in the next segment of A Touch of Gray, we'll be joined by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. That's next, when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined, as promised, by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who a few minutes from now will be talking with Thomas Cathcart, a Harvard grad with a degree in philosophy, who wrote an interesting book called The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge?, published by Workman Publishing. Richard, you've already conducted this interview, and it's going to have its world premiere in just a few minutes here on A Touch of Gray. I haven't got a clue what that book is about. What is this? Who's throwing some fat guy off a bridge? And why is it a trolley problem? And why should we care?
It's actually very interesting. I think the whole problem with the book and why it may not sell is people go, what the heck is this?
Right.
But it's really very interesting. It poses philosophical problems, things that will never happen to you in real life, but things that will get you thinking about your morals, your ethics, what you would do in a given situation. I mean, it's almost one of those things where the elevator is coming down and, you know, if you jump at the last second, can you save yourself? It's almost one of those things.
Okay, well, we'll find out what the trolley problem is in just a moment when we listen to this conversation. And then after we listen to this conversation, maybe we can talk a little bit about these problems, these conundrums, these philosophical quagmires that we find ourselves in. And sometimes in real life they do occur, not just
in terms of theory. Actually, this trolley problem will never occur in real life to you, but you can expand it to other situations that may, and maybe form a philosophy of your own.
My curiosity is piqued. We shall listen intently in just a moment. Thank you, Richard. Richard will be back. And we're going to hear him talking about the trolley problem, or would you throw the fat guy off the bridge, with Thomas Cathcart. Next, when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
Hi, this is Jerry Rice. All kids have dreams. Mine was to play professional football. But for some, a medical problem might stand in the way. That's why Shriners Hospitals are so important. Shriners is a network of 22 hospitals, providing some of the world's best orthopedic and burn medical care, totally free of charge. And there's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area. If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055 for more information. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
There are a ton of social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. This one saves lives. It's MatchingDonors.com. MatchingDonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you're someone in need of an organ transplant, visit MatchingDonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life, MatchingDonors.com.
How many more good jobs will America lose before somebody does something about it? Somebody is. By rebuilding our manufacturing base so America can be number one in the world economy. It's the Keep It Made in America campaign, sponsored by the Alliance for American Manufacturing. And we're rallying support for our campaign at a town hall meeting right here in your community. We're leading this effort to convince our nation's leaders that an overwhelming majority of us understand that rebuilding manufacturing is essential for restoring America's economic leadership. Learn how we're standing up to China, why it's working, and how you can help make it more successful. Join leaders from your community at the Keep It Made in America Town Hall. Join our campaign to save American manufacturing. To find out where the town hall meeting in your community is being held, visit our website, www.americanmanufacturing.org. Sponsored by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, Michael Harrison here in the anchor chair, and as promised, here is our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, in conversation with Thomas Cathcart. He graduated from Harvard with a degree in philosophy, and he's going to talk to Richard about his interesting new book, The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge? It's published by Workman Publishing.
I'm sure most people hearing that title would go, what the heck is this all about? So, Thomas, tell us what the trolley problem, succinctly, what the trolley problem and the fat guy on the bridge are.
Okay. The original trolley problem, well, actually a slight variation on the original trolley problem, is this. There's an out-of-control trolley barreling down the track, and you are standing on the ground. You see that the trolley is going to hit five people who are standing on the track and have no way of getting off. But you also notice that you're standing next to a switch, and if you pull that switch, you're going to divert the trolley onto a siding. And if it goes onto the siding, it will avoid the five people, but unfortunately there's one person standing on the siding. So the question is, would you pull the switch? Most people say yes, they would. Some people say no, they wouldn't, because that's playing God. You know, you're causing the death of an innocent person who otherwise would have been quite safe. Most people say, yeah, they would, because better lose one than five. So now the second scenario is you're standing on a footbridge over the track, and you see the out-of-control trolley coming, and you see that it's going to hit five people behind you beyond the footbridge. But there's no siding, there's no switch. the only possible way of saving the five people would be to drop a heavy weight in front of the trolley to stop it. So you look around on the footbridge, you don't see any heavy weights, except you notice you're standing next to a very heavy man. So now the question is, do you still feel the same way, that it's better to sacrifice one than five? And so do you push the fat guy off the bridge? That is the trolley problem.
And most people would say no to the latter and yes to the former, right?
That's correct, yes. Yeah.
Why do I think that this might have something to do with drones?
Oh, you are good. Yeah, well, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, the question is, you know, if there's going to be so-called collateral damage, you got to hate that word, but that's the word they use, collateral damage. Innocent civilians are going to be struck by the drone attack. Do you go ahead and do it anyway because it's outweighed by supposedly the greater good of hitting your military target? So in many ways, it's very similar to the trolley problem.
Well, and it also, to me, touches on gun control, because most people will tell you, psychologists will tell you, that to fire a gun at somebody and shoot them is a lot less personal than if you have to stab them multiple times with a knife to kill them.
Ah, very interesting, huh? Yeah, very interesting.
And the visceral act of pushing the fat man off as opposed to just throwing a switch,
yep,
is the big difference, no?
Yep, for sure. Well, that's the difference that some people cite. Various people say various things. Some people say what matters is your intent. If you pull the switch, you don't intend for the person on the siding to get hit. That's just an unfortunate byproduct of your action. But if you push the guy off the bridge, you actually intend for him to be hit, because otherwise the five people won't be saved. So you could, theoretically, you could hope that the man on the siding would jump off the siding, even though in the problem that's not a possibility, but you can't help hoping that he'll get out of the way somehow. You don't really want to cause his death. In the case of the fat man, you have to hope that he doesn't get off, that you don't miss the track when you push him off, because you need the train to hit him in order to save the five. So some people say that's the difference. People have different ideas about what the difference is, but interestingly, most people say, I don't have a clue what the difference is. It just feels different to me. It just feels different to me.
Well, and of course, one of the big problems with this, Thomas, is we're analyzing this after the fact as opposed to if it happens spontaneously, and you have to make that snap judgment, and you can't think about it, and you can't analyze it later.
Yeah, that's right. That's the sort of fake part of it, is that, of course, you couldn't. In a real-life situation, we'd probably all do the same thing. We'd bumble around until it was too late and the trolley did whatever it was going to do. But, yeah, but theoretically, the question is, if you could figure it out, what would you do?
And I've often thought that a lot of what we call morality has to do with consequences, that things we do that we think we can get away with and nobody will know, or it may hurt some big anonymous corporation, but individuals don't get hurt by it. Yeah, I mean, we might do that. But if we can see a direct consequence of our action, we're much, much more hesitant. Would you agree with that?
Actually, I would agree with that, and I think that actually translates into the trolley problem a bit. Even though you actually see the result in both cases, somehow seeing it from the bridge and seeing it from the siding are two different things. And, yeah, you do feel more responsible, I think, and you probably think that other people are going to hold you more responsible, because you know that people generally agree that a pilot whose plane is out of control should try to land it in the suburbs rather than the city so that he'll kill fewer people, even though that kills a lot of people who would have been safe otherwise in the suburbs. People sort of understand that. So you think, well, I probably wouldn't be judged if I pulled the switch. But you would probably be judged by other people if you pushed the fat man.
And that's why I think we celebrate those who are willing to give up their own lives for the safety of other people. And that is something that does happen at times when you have to make that sacrifice. If you're the pilot, you have to go in nose first and maybe save the passengers, knowing that you're going to be the first casualty.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Because one of the reasons that they pose it as pushing a fat man off the bridge is the person has to be heavier than you, because Otherwise, the question would be, why don't you jump in front of the train? And so to sort of take that option off the table and posing the puzzle, they make it a guy who's fatter than you are. But, yeah, that is, and there is an interesting variation on the trolley problem that somebody came up with online, and that is that somebody has tied you to the track on the siding. And you see that the five people on the main track are going to get hit. But you see that by stretching your leg out far enough, you can get a hold of the switch with your foot, and you can divert it to run over yourself. Then what do you do?
Mm. Well, the other part of it, too, is how much of a role does religion play in a lot of these decisions in terms of being instructive as to what to do? And I find that in a lot of cases, you could talk to several different theologians, and they'll give you several different answers.
I think that's probably right, yeah. And it speaks to the fact that it's such a gray area. The whole problem is sort of made to make you, whatever reason you come up with, look foolish. And religious people actually do answer it differently. Some people try to apply the golden rule. But it depends on who you compare the person to. Is it better? Do you not pull the switch because you want to do unto others as you would have others do unto you, and so you want to save the guy on the siding, or do you push the switch because you identify with the five people on the track? So depending on who you decide to identify yourself with, doing unto others as you would have others do unto you is ambiguous.
The other part of that is you mentioned God before, and a lot of people say, well, what would Jesus do? And here we're putting ourselves in the position of God or Jesus and making a decision for him or her or whatever, having no idea what they would actually do, but just what we think they would do, and if, in fact, they exist, we have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah. Yeah. Even because in a way, whether you are a believer or not a believer, essentially what the question asks is for you to put yourself in a godlike position and decide the fate of another human being and five other human beings besides. So, yeah, it's a religious question in a way, whether you're religious or not.
Of course, there's the issue of who sent the train that way in the first place. I often look at news reports when they interview somebody who was in the path of a tornado and somehow escaped, and they thank God for it. And Wolf Blitzer was interviewing a woman once, and she said, well, I don't actually believe in God, so I don't know. But I'd love somebody to say, well, excuse me, who sent the tornado in the first place? We call it an act of God, don't we?
That's right. Yeah. Even insurance companies call that an act of God. Yeah.
So, well, Thomas,
there's one where your theology does make a big difference.
Yeah.
A lot of people would say, well, God didn't send the tornado. That's not who God is. God doesn't do that. But other people would say, well, God determines everything.
Finally, at the end of the book, you make a case for, well, is it really worth it to contemplate these things? And make the case that it is.
Okay. Yeah. Some people would say, the question is trivial, and, even after you think about it and look at all the angles, you don't come up with any different answer. So why bother? And I think part of the answer is that it's just, it develops something in you. It may not develop an objective answer to the question, but by putting you through all of the things you have to go through to make that decision, it changes you in some way. It makes you more articulate in an ethical way. It makes you more able to talk about your ethics with another person. It just gives you a richer vocabulary to think about things. And I think there's a case to be made for why it isn't a trivial problem. That's really the answer. That, philosophy changes you, and thinking about these things changes you. It changes the way you look at them, and it changes the richness of your experience. It changes the all the factors and vectors that you bring to bear on something, and that's worth something in and of itself.
That's Thomas Cathcart in conversation with Richard Neer. The book, and we finally understand now what it's all about. Thank you, Richard. Very interesting, as a matter of fact. Richard was telling us the truth. It's fascinating. The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge, published by Workman Publishing. Well, that sort of stimulated my philosophical membranes. So we're going to talk a little bit about philosophy with Richard right after the break. When A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best. So take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison, and we've come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast, our big two-hour weekend broadcast, and we are joined again by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, fresh off of that interesting conversation with Thomas Cathcart, the author of The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge, published by Workman Publishing. Well, kind of interesting, and, you know, I guess we often hear, Richard, that there are these tests that test your ethics, like whether you're a moral person or whether you are immoral, whether you're honest, dishonest, whether you're selfish or not selfish. You know, if you were in the situation, you know, it's like, who would you save? You know, if you have two people drowning, you know, two people that you care about in different parts of your life and they're both drowning and you can only save one of them. That's the kind of question that this thing really dealt with. It's not so much philosophical as it is, how do you really feel about things?
Well, in this case, it's would you sacrifice one for the greater good, which opens up a whole lot of political things, is that, you know, well, what if you had to make that choice? And these are choices, I guess, the President of the United States has to make every day. Well, I'm going to send troops into here, and maybe it'll be good overall, but we're going to have casualties. And those are the kinds of things that you never know until the answer comes, until it turns out, because until you're faced with that situation, Michael, I think you can have all the philosophy in the world and all the, well, in this case, this is what I would do. But until actually confronted with that situation, you don't know what you would do.
No, you don't know. You don't know how your mind and body connection are going to react to two things. One is fear,
mm-hmm.
and one is anger, rage. Sometimes anger causes us to do things that we never would dream we would do if we were in a normal, relaxed, meditative state, talking philosophically. And then, have you ever gotten angry where you say, I can't believe the feelings I just had?
Well,
I would wring that guy's throat, you know.
Well, basically, what you're saying is that in periods of stress, emotion overtakes intellect with most of us, and I would have to agree with that.
Yeah, yeah, and fear. You know, it's very easy to say, I would, you know, fight for my country, or I would defend my family, or I would, and then you go, I'm getting out of here, you know, and you run away screaming. And I mean, I don't know, I can't see myself doing that, but I'm more concerned with my anger and my bravery. I sometimes get myself in trouble because I have learned at this point in my life, and I'm not boasting, I'm talking just candidly, I sometimes scare myself by how brave I am in the face of trouble. Like as you're running into that burning building, and you know there's a family in there, or there's a baby in there, and you're safe on the sidewalk, and you're just walking by, and all of a sudden you're running into the burning building, do you say to yourself, what the heck am I doing? Why am I putting my life at risk? But I'm running. See, I've had that happen to me a couple of times where I've actually run toward danger to save somebody or help somebody, knowing that this may be one of those stories where the guy gets killed, me, for doing something brave, because he didn't stand on the sidewalk.
I can't let you not be a little specific, at least with one of these instances.
I was driving on a highway one night, late at night, and a car in front of me turned over. And there was nobody else around. This was out in Los Angeles. And I was coming home from a radio station job, and I got off at like 1 in the morning. The car in front of me made a turn at the last second to go onto another freeway, caught the lip of the fence, turned over on its back, and I pulled over to the side of the highway, empty, deserted road, and started running toward the car. And while I'm running to the car, I'm going, what am I doing? Why am I running to this car? It might blow up. And I pulled the people out. And I left.
You're a hero.
didn't hang around.
You are a hero. Now, this is prior to cell phones, right, where you couldn't just call 911.
Many years ago, 30 years ago. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe more. And we're out of time, so I got to run. So we'll leave it at that. And I don't want anybody sending me any letters or cards. Well, okay.
People will say, you saved my life, Michael.
It was you.
It was you. Here's my $1 million.
Thank you, Richard Deere. Thank you, Beverly Santinello. Thank you, Carol Marks. Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Thank you, Kevin Casey. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. And join us next weekend right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.